going to pray for us before we start here, and then catch us up on where we are, because it's been 2 weeks. Some of our brains, myself included, we forget what we did yesterday, let alone 2 weeks ago. So we'll have to just, I'll give you a little running start to catch up where we're at, and then we will pick up a lot of fascinating things in this period, like all periods. And this happens that we're coming into the period where really is my specialty, because when I did my graduate work, it was late 19th, early 20th century that I worked in. And so fascinating things going on here, a period of great turmoil in America, a great turmoil in the churches in America as well. So we'll pick up a little bit about foreign missions, then we'll get into the briefly talk about sort of the last years of what some have called Protestant America, and talk briefly about that, and then we're going to get into what I call Protestantism shaken, all of the intellectual turmoil and the rapid rise of urban America as opposed to rural America being the dominant cultural landscape, shall we say, and how this caused huge challenges for the churches in the late 19th and early 20th century. Hopefully getting into the so-called fundamentalist modernist controversy as well. So let's pray. Gracious Lord, we thank you for the opportunity to reflect, study, think about the history of your people in our land, and ask and pray that you guide us as we reflect on this material this evening. For in Christ's name we pray. Amen. Foreign missions. 19th century. We've been moving through the 19th century. It's been called the Great Century as far as foreign missions. And the Great Century of Christian influence in the United States. We sometimes will talk about the founding fathers and colonial America and the Christian influence, but some have argued that in one sense the high point of real overall Christian influence is the 19th century. And if we measure it by church membership and particularly missionary emphasis, the 19th century fits that bill. Lots of key promoters, mission promoters, student mission conferences. I mentioned a couple of the men here, J.R. Mott and Robert Speer, big promoters of foreign missions. Mott worked with the student volunteer movement, was with the YMCA before that. Speer was the foreign missions executive with Northern Presbyterian Church, but he worked rather interdenominationally. Both were huge promoters of foreign missions, and this was the time when the churches really began to cooperate. They had a committee on cooperation in Latin America. This is when the so-called This is also the time when the so-called ecumenical movement develops. What is sometimes in some circles the ecumenical movement gets a really bad name, or ecumenism. But really, what the ecumenical movement was started as was an idea that if we're sending out missionaries to northern Uganda, let's just pick a place. I have no idea what missionaries in the 19th century were in northern Uganda. I just know my own denomination has missionaries in northern Uganda. That's probably why I picked it. But let's just say three different churches decide to work in the same region in northern Uganda, and 100 miles away, there are no missions working there. Mission executives all would get together and say, this stuff somehow doesn't seem too smart. Why don't one of us go down there 100 miles away? There are no Christians there. And we share at least a basic, generic evangelical Protestant faith, and there's nobody down there, and why should we all congregate here? And sometimes the African converts couldn't always tell the difference, frankly, between American churches. Friend that spent some time in Kenya, and he said when he worked at the African Evangelical Presbyterian Church, the African Inland Mission Church was just not that far away, and there was some overlap in some of the same people. And he said, when you ask the people what was the difference, they would give you answer, one of them allows us to keep our second wives, and one of them makes us put our second wives away. That was their difference in their mind between one group and another. They both preached basic biblical Christianity on an elementary level when you're dealing with brand new converts. And when they asked the tribesmen sometimes who had had never had been exposed to Christianity before, that's the kind of answers they got. So in that environment, these mission agencies started cooperating. Well, once you start cooperating in lots of things, then all kinds of questions about shouldn't we do further cooperation? As we're going to see, this is also the time when you have the great rising of cooperative evangelism, the great crusade evangelists. We've had them before with Finney, but we're going to see during this period of D.L. Moody and Billy Sunday, a couple of other people like Charles Alexander and Wilbur Chapman in between. And they were rather broad in their appeal. So this is the time when ecumenical movement gets started. Foreign missions expands. One of the big issues with foreign missions, we should briefly probably also mention the first point up there about the prominent role of women. Over 60% of the missionaries that went out were women, and many of them single women went out in places that would frighten the dickens out of men with armed guards. And single women would go into those places sometimes and would become teachers and Bible teachers and be very active in mission work. What this meant then was, of course, it raised questions about what other roles should women have in the church that would be done differently sometimes from one denomination to the other. The Women's Missionary Society would become a powerful force in the church itself, raising money, sending money for missions. Some women found much of their church engagement would be in the Women's Missionary Society. So this is a great role of foreign missions. What we also have, though, is eventually new attempts at reform, and we'll talk briefly about this. But one last thing about missions. One of the key issues that sometimes gets raised, and I don't have a note on it, but it's worth talking about here, is the connection between so-called imperialism and foreign missions. You might say, what is imperialism? Imperialism is the idea that you impose either your government or your culture on another culture. Usually it's from the more advanced culture imposing its culture or its government on a less advanced culture. Now, the European imperialism usually meant the British or the French or the Johnny-come-lately Germans, which they were late in the game. They only got Cameroon and Tanganyika in Africa, in the so-called scramble for Africa, that was all that was left. And that's why they took those, that's all they could get. But they would come in, make them a colony, extract wealth. The Belgians were also there, but they were the worst of the bunch because King Leopold had it as his own private colony and he had basically slave labor going on in the so-called Belgian Congo. But oftentimes missionaries would come in. Now the French sometimes would be different than the Belgians, as I said, were turned out to be quite bad. The Germans, okay. The British were very congenial and a very soft kind of imperialism. The French went into Northwest Africa and recruited Senegalese troops and armed them with the latest repeating rifles and marched put French generals in charge of training and made crack troops around them and marched them all over Africa and conquered half of Africa with their Senegalese troops. And sometimes then French Roman Catholic missionaries would follow that. The British also opened it widely for other Commonwealth and American missionaries. Now the whole question for American missionaries was, technically we did very little raw imperialism of that kind, other than the Philippines. That was the one country we probably had came closest to real imperialism, because we took over the Philippines after the Spanish-American War. McKinley said this, he was a Methodist, President McKinley, he was speaking at the Methodist General Conference, and he said something, we're going to go over there to Christianize and westernize the Filipinos. And they were all one breath to him. There was no difference in his mind between westernizing and Christianizing the Filipinos. I mean, this is the great period when American congregations love to get the missionary newsletter, and you would see the before and after picture. And what was the before picture? bones through their nose, you know, a little loincloth on with a spear and 100, you know, earrings hanging everywhere. The after, black pants, white shirt, everybody looking very Western. Well, is that imperialism? Well, yes and no. It's a kind of a cultural imperialism, if you want to call it that, because we brought our Western culture. We brought the dress that was connected with American culture. Sometimes we brought more than that, even. We would sometimes, you would hear people, they'd be in Korea, for example. Korea was hugely impacted around in the first couple of decades of the 20th century by American missionaries, mostly Presbyterian and Methodist, some Baptists were there as well. And to the point where today, South Korea is quite a high percentage for Christians. But if you talk to Koreans about what kind of hymns they sing, it's American hymns and British hymns translated into Korean. That's a kind of cultural imperialism, because it's the missionaries brought their hymns. They just translated them into Korean. And they have a common hymnal. It doesn't matter which denomination you belong to. In South Korea, pretty much you sing the same hymns. You'll hear them. You'll hear that you'll recognize the tune. You can't understand a word they're saying if you don't speak Korean, but you say, I know that tune. That's a classic Western hymn tune. In other words, the missionaries had minimal interest in indigenous music or anything like that. So that's kind of an imperialism. But the people who complain the most about imperialism are most upset with the beliefs and values. And this is where evangelical Protestant Christians, whether you're British or German or Norwegian or American, really, when push comes to shove, we say, well, if you want to call it imperialism, I guess you call it imperialism, but we believe in that the gospel is the truth, and so we have a responsibility to bring the truth to people. And yes, you know, if you would have asked the missionaries from this era, are you an imperialist, they probably might have scratched their head. No, the British, the French, they're imperialists. They got those armies, and they conquered them. They shoot people who don't bow the knee to them. We just follow. But Americans, frankly, followed the British mild imperialism very carefully. Most American missionaries were most successful where the British imperialistic system had gone before. In those countries, you know, India and Africa, the places in China. It wasn't until the China Inland Mission went into central China that missionaries even penetrated into central China. Before that, where did they stay? On the coast. That's where the gunboats were. That's where it was easier to do mission work. So it's a yes and no kind of thing on imperialism. And depending on how you look at imperialism, I thought this would be worthwhile for us just to briefly talk. We can talk more about that, but just to be aware of that issue. Now, new attempts at the reform of society. We've all heard about temperance movement, but what many people don't realize, and good historians recognize this, Ken Burns did a wonderful series on prohibition, and in his very first session, he points out very clearly that prohibition was a progressive / liberally driven movement in its heyday. Yes, lots of evangelical Protestants got on the bandwagon and thought it was a great idea. But you have to understand that you could just as well call prohibition an element of the so-called social gospel as you could evangelical Protestants trying to impose their values on society. I have read fairly widely in some of the literature in this period. It's amazing when you read this sometimes how people argue that if you just got rid of booze, all of the problems of society would disappear almost instantaneously. Really, I mean, it didn't matter whether you were a liberal progressive senator or an evangelical Protestant revival preacher, the same kind of words came out of their mouths. If we just get rid of booze, everything will get. Billy Sunday, the evangelist, even had his famous booze sermon, he called it, in which he would go on a very strong preaching about the evils of booze. Well, yes, there was a lot of real truth in some of this, because especially in working class city environments, the man worked in the steel mills in a rough, rugged place. I worked in steel mills when they had cleaned those things up a lot here in Indiana when I was in college. That was in clean days, steel mills. 100 years earlier, 50 to 7,500 years earlier, when the steel mills were in their really dirty phase, and people could fall into vats easily. There were no roads. It was a rough job, mostly immigrants. No problems. Yes, there was a problem that they paid you in cash, and you walked by, and you had to get it. Most people walked to because they lived close by there, and you had 35 taverns, but you had to get by, and it would be difficult to get by 35 taverns. So if you were a man that was used to imbibing a snootful here or there, and the 35 taverns were calling at you. There was a real legitimate problem with alcohol hurting society. But there was this sense that prohibition was, which was the progressive issue par excellence, about how society could genuinely be revamped. Now, pre-Civil War, there had already been a temperance, strong temperance, direction, Lyman Beecher's six sermons against temperance in 1826 had sparked laws in Maine and Massachusetts. Maine actually went dry for a short time. People don't realize that there were several states in Maine that went dry long before national prohibition. Sometimes it became a rural versus urban issue. Sometimes it became immigrant versus old Yankee stock sort of thing, because the old Yankee stock were more likely to pick up prohibition than the immigrants were. There was a prohibition party founded in 1869, and they've been running ever since then. When I was at the college that I went to, I visited Enoch A. Holdwick Hall, who was a history professor at the college I went to, an Evangelical Methodist college, who was like a four-time presidential candidate for the Prohibition Party. They get a couple percent. The highest that they've ever got was 1892, when they got 2% of the vote. They still get a tiny percentage today still, the Prohibition Party does. The Methodists were the denomination most flavored with the temperance sentiment. Now, that may surprise somebody. Some today. One may have assumed perhaps it would be the Baptists. No, Methodists were the driving force in the 19th century for temperance. But most of the evangelical churches eventually came in for a part of it. They had political connections. Sometimes there was a lot of pressure. And the head of the Anti-Saloon League, for example, which was the political pressure group, political group of the temperance movement, put huge pressure to get more and more temperance prohibition. Of course, we all know they finally got it in the 1920s, and it didn't work out quite as well as they thought. Although, people forget, actual consumption of alcohol went down dramatically, at least in the first few years. It did. Actual consumption of alcohol went down. What they just didn't count on was the Al Capones of this world, who looked at this and saw this is a gold mine for people like me. Because there are still people who have a hankering for booze, and we will go into business providing booze. They used it. Now they're into drugs and other sorts of illicit things, but then it was booze. Francis Willard was a key figure. There are names up there. WCTU stands for the Women's Christian Temperance Union. She was a Methodist. She had served for a teacher for a while in Evanston, Illinois, became the leader of the WCTU, which actually eventually broadened some of its reforms to focus on protection of the family. She oftentimes, people don't know this, worked strong closely in conjunction with D.L. Moody, the famous evangelist. But she also was a strong advocate of women's issues, women's ordination, and she drifted at the end of her life and toward politically to a form of Christian-based socialism. The evangelicals started to really work hard to have political clout about 1895, at the end of the 19th century, when they formed the Anti-Saloon League, largely was staffed and formed by evangelicals. And nicknamed it the Church in Action Against the Saloon. The final victory, of course, was prohibition, and this is seen by some as the high point of evangelical political influence. That's when they got prohibition passed. Here's a good example of how this goes. We'll talk a little bit more about Billy Sunday hopefully later tonight. He's an interesting character. Billy Sunday, the flamboyant evangelist, in 1920, had a mock funeral service for the death of John Barleycorn. In other words, to him, this was the high point of victories. So let's talk a little bit about more about the cultural impact and talk about this culmination of Protestant politics. Because during this period of time, we probably have the late 19th, early 20th century, some of the most explicitly Christian presidents, for example. Rutherford Hayes was a Methodist. His wife was an early prohibitionist. She was a Lucy, and she refused to serve booze in the White House. And she went down in history as Lemonade Lucy, because she would only serve lemonade in the White House. James Garfield, who was a short-term president because he was shot, was a Disciples of Christ lay minister. He also refused to serve alcohol. McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt were advocates of the so-called muscular Christianity, which was, Billy Sunday would epitomize that, a firm fighting, because evangelical Protestantism had become rather feminized in some ways in the 19th century. There were whole books written about that, the feminization of American culture. They've argued that the church was sort of complicit in this. And then there was a reaction in the 1890s for a more muscular version. The YMCA was a classic example of that, where you go and you work out and you play vigorous games. You ever seen the Chariots of Fire movie? And Eric Little is kind of an example. In fact, there's even a reference to a muscular kind of Christianity in that movie. The peak is in the 1920s, but it starts about in the 1890s. And this would flow over into a kind of Christian politics. And William Jennings Bryan, where his date's up there, his nickname was the Boy Orator of the Platte. That's because he was from Nebraska, Platte, North and South Platte River. It's kind of the example of this. He was a presidential candidate in 1886, 1900, and 1908. He served as Secretary of State from 1913. He was an evangelical Presbyterian active in his church. He saw politics as a forum for promoting American and Christian principles of morality. Incredibly outspoken. Interesting thing about him, he was a member of the Democratic Party. And he was also somebody who had some very strong views about so-called robber barons, the wealthy Wall Street people. Very much spoke in that against them. He had a special interest in the welfare of farmers and workers. Probably his most famous political speech was on the issue of the gold standard. He was very much opposed to the gold standard. And in 1896, when he got the nomination for the Democratic presidential candidacy, he was a candidate, he never did win, but he gave his famous cross of gold speech, and he said, "You will not crucify this nation on a cross of gold." So Harry even brought biblical images into his opposition to the gold standard. He was really fighting the relative prosperity which Republican politics had brought to many urbanites in small northern towns. And his whole campaign was very, as a motivational speaker, did not always make him the best mender of political fences sometimes. He was a pioneer, though, in promoting better treatment of workers, fairness, vote for women, and respect for common citizens. And he was an advocate of international arbitration. And here's why he resigned from Secretary of State. He was opposed to us entering World War I. He was Wilson's Secretary of State. And when Wilson, who had promised he was going to keep us out of the war, after the sinking of the Lusitania and a few of these other things, urged Congress to declare war, Bryan resigned in protest. Now, most people know about Bryan from something else. If you've seen that absolutely hideous movie with Spencer Tracy, and that's the only way to describe it, is about as historically inaccurate as a movie as you could ever find. I like Spencer Tracy as an actor, but the movie's Inherit the Wind was really a political tract, and it shows the character, they call him Matthew Brady or something, but he's a William Jennings Bryan character, and they make him look like a buffoon. William Jennings Bryan was no buffoon, and he probably got in over his head in the Scopes Smoky Trials, as they called, because they asked him questions about science that he didn't know about, and he just would then speculate and say, well, I don't know about this. And so they would ask. And by the way, interestingly enough, that whole Scopes monkey trial was another thing. We may talk briefly a bit about more, but let me just talk a couple of sentences about it now. It was basically a setup. The ACLU found somebody, a teacher who was willing to purposely break the law so they'd have a court case, and the guy got a little tiny fine, and he kind of reluctantly did it, but it was all designed to be a publicity stunt. Absolutely was. And it brought all sorts of people down there, and Mencken with his snide comments, H.L. Mencken, the skeptical gadfly who said, in this part of Tennessee, he says, you just swing your arm and you'll hit a fundamentalist or something like that. In other words, he's saying they're everywhere down here in this part of eastern Tennessee. But Brian went down there to defend the state law. But interesting thing about Brian, he wasn't even, today there are a lot of people who are hardcore young earth creationists wouldn't like Brian, because Brian was a day age guy. He believed in an old earth and believed in a bunch of other things. Let's put it this way. Ken Ham or the creation science people would have really repudiated Brian's whole approach and thought and would have said it's not right. It's compromising. But he's the guy that goes down as the great champion of fundamentalist obscurantist sort of stuff. And he wasn't. He probably got in too high. But you have to also put his crusades against evolution in their context. Why did he oppose evolution? Because he argued this. The Germans are the example of people who take survival of the fittest, might makes right, seriously, and look what they did in World War I. If you adopt, he said, Darwinian evolution with its ideology of survival of the fittest, might makes right, you become like the Kaiser and all of his troops. You run over anybody. In other words, his opposition to evolution was a principled cultural opposition, not primarily a scientific opposition. A lot of people miss that. In other words, we would today call it a worldview opposition. He said this evolution as a worldview is seriously a problem. And that's why he opposed evolution. And sometimes people miss the whole thing. And I really ran into somebody one time who was a big labor union man, who's really, would have adopted every left-wing cause you could ever find, and he had picked up a biography of Brian one time. He said, I'm surprised at this guy. I found that I agreed with this guy a whole lot more than I thought I would. And I said, well, that's just because, I told him, I said, that's because you probably watched the wind too much or something like that, and I've gotten a very skewed notion of what drove William Jennings Bryan. Okay. Yeah, we had also, during this period, a couple of other Wilson. Now, Wilson is an interesting character because he was a reforming Democrat, and he was also a man who had spent time as a history professor, a political science, professor, and a college president at Princeton University before he became governor of New Jersey and then became president. It's an interesting question. That makes me presidents. Wilson doesn't prove that it worked real well. But we've had all kinds of other people who've gone to be presidents. You have to be a judge of how you think some of the others worked out as well. Interestingly enough, he was the son of a Southern Presbyterian minister, had experienced a conversion as a young man, read the Bible daily, prayed daily, and clearly saw, just like Brian, politics as an extension of his faith. However, while he believed the principles of Christian morality could be translated into public policy, two things were an issue here. First of all, he had started to imbibe what we will discuss more later tonight, the more liberal versions of the Christian faith that were starting to percolate with their more optimistic view of human nature. In fact, he had an uncle that started advocating evolution. His uncle was a professor at a Southern Presbyterian seminary and was booted out of there. Woodrow. His uncle's last name was Woodrow, and he was named after this uncle. So he'd started to imbibe some of that. The other thing is, he seemed to have had a certain amount of naivete. But for example, when he ran into Henry George and Georges Clemenceau, the hard-nosed, real politics sort of French and English politicians who said, the Germans must pay for World War I. He didn't know what to do, because he was going to go over there with his 14 points, make the world safe with democracy, go over and just tell them the wonderful things we need to do, and he was shocked to find that the French and German political leaders wanted nothing to hear about this. What was their attitude? Got to get those Germans. That's what they wanted to do. They didn't want to hear some idealistic American who, they said, we spent 4 years and lost thousands and millions of men in the trenches. You Yanks came over here for about a year, mopped up at Belleau Wood a little bit. Yeah, you lost a few men, but not like we did. We dictate the peace treaty here. And they gave them the Treaty of Versailles, which 20 years later led to Hitler, of course, to a great extent. But he couldn't even get the United States Senate to pass the Versailles Treaty. He was famous for the League of Nations. This was, in his mind, application of Christian values to political life. So, you learn a lesson from that? Sometimes taking Christian values and putting them into politics doesn't work as smoothly as we think they will. At least Wilson thought he was putting things into Christian values, his Christian values into politics, and it really, he ended up with egg on his face all over the place. The real world sometimes is far less congenial place to some. I'm not saying he shouldn't have tried. What I'm saying is it didn't work as smoothly as he thought it was. Now, in this same period is the rise of the social gospel. Now, to really put the social gospel in its full context, in a few minutes we will talk about the rise of Protestant liberalism. What we want to talk about, put it here in the societal issue. Why the social gospel? Well, it was the fact that the U.S. economy had changed greatly in the years between the Civil War and World War I. The population of the U.S. tripled during that time. The number of businesses had increased 8 times. The gross national product had increased 30 times. We'd gone from the era of small towns, small businessmen, small farmers, to the era of the Rockefellers, the Carnegies, the J.P. Morgans. And those are sort of common names to most of us. The big fat cats, if you will, on Wall Street. People who bought up the competition, cooked deals. And it changed, in some ways, a lot of the American economy. But it also, it was a society in which, into this, we're seeing much more urbanization. And we're seeing huge influx of immigrants, especially into the larger cities. There was a little comment in this one book I was reading, talking about Chicago. This fits me because some of my ancestors immigrated to Chicago. My ancestors lived not too far from where the fires, the Great Chicago Fire in 1871 started. She saw it as a young girl. But Chicago in 1830-something, was it 32, 35, going by memory here, it was a small town with like 30 or 40 houses. After the Civil War, it was a huge city. Immigrants were pouring in. Chicago is an interesting example because Chicago would have an ethnic neighborhood eventually for every conceivable ethnic group. My ancestors lived in, there were like 3 small Dutch enclaves, and they lived in one of those, they lived in at least, I think, all 3 of them. The near west side, my great-grandma, then there was one on the south side and one on the far south side. I had ancestors that lived in each one of them, but there were Norwegian enclaves and Danish enclaves and German and Irish and eventually Polish and Ukrainian. There were more Poles in Chicago than any city in the world except Warsaw. That's true. More Poles than any city of the world except Warsaw, Poland. Italians of all sorts. I mean, you just name me, you know, Albanians, Slovenians, you name it, they were there. Why did they come? I can tell you why some of my ancestors came, because there were, in the case of my ancestors, there was a minister who had been converted in middle age and had been a farm laborer. And he had gone to the ministry, Dutch minister. He emigrated and was pastoring First Reformed Church on the west side of Chicago. He wrote back, they were published in the local Northern Netherlands. Groningen is the province where some of my answers came from, the newspaper. And people recognized Bernardus de Bie. They said, we knew him. He used to be one of us. He was a farm laborer. He's a straight shooter. He didn't trust all the ministers. Somebody thought some of them got gold pulled over their eyes. All this, not him. He was a straight shooter. He said, if you want to come work, lots of work in Chicago. Well, lots of Dutch immigrants came to Chicago, and every other kind of immigrant came to Chicago. Dutchmen got into the garbage business. Yeah, they did. Waste management was originally founded by people from Chicago in the garbage business. That's the truth. Wayne Heisinger, my dad had a business partner with the same last name. They founded waste management, so that's when the garbage business in the United States got to start. Dutch immigrants in Chicago. But they had steel mills, slaughterhouses, people living there, sometimes in bad conditions. Sinclair Lewis wrote his famous The Jungle, talking about the bad conditions. This is a totally different kind of America than the America that people had lived in. The churches tried to adjust to this. The social gospel was one way. And it was to argue that the goal of the church is to primarily meet physical and cultural needs, poverty, food. Can you see how the alcohol prohibition fit right in with that? But there were also evangelical versions. The most common, most known, well-known one. You still see them out. They're little kettles. The Salvation Army comes from this era. By the way, I'm a brass player. And some of you may not know this. Why do Salvation Armies have brass bands? It's because they came from working class England. And you can play a cornet. You can play a euphonium. You can play a tuba. Play a trombone with thick, calloused hands. Try playing a clarinet or a violin with those kind of hands. That's why they started brass bands. And so brass bands have been with the Salvation Army ever since then. Great, they have huge brass bands. Great musician. That's something you know about that. But anyway, they had this tradition of reaching out. They started rescue missions. Famous Pacific Garden Mission, South State Street in Chicago. Our church would go there every month, and I went there many times with my dad and other men from the church I grew up in South Suburban Chicago. And it was it's called Skid Row District, which where the flop houses were. And they had a mission. They still have, my dad still had this Pacific Garden Mission designated as one of the places to send, because he had a real love for that. But they actually had to relocate in Chicago because the area got gentrified. It wasn't the Skid Row anymore. They had to move it like a mile west of there or something like that to get to the place where the flop houses were. Well, all of this was an attempt to try to minister to social needs. The Salvation Army by 1900 had 900 corps in the Salvation Army. They really have they're like a Methodist church without sacraments, but they don't call it a church, they call it a corps. But they have services and they have officers instead of ministers. The soldiers are the regular people. The officers are like your minister. And so they had their own system. But all of this meant that there was a serious attempt to reach out to people who were down and outers, struggling. Now, the real hardcore social gospel that was connected with liberal theology focused oftentimes on things like fair labor practices, right to organize as an extension of the golden rule. The famous Sheldon's In His Steps. It was the earliest version of What Would Jesus Do? He was a minister in Topeka, Kansas. He had other people like Walter Rauschenbusch. Yeah, that was his name. I always spelled this one wrong. He was a German immigrant, Walter Rauschenbusch. He actually wrote a book called The Theology of the Social Gospel. He was a German Baptist, and he had grown up in an area of New York that had the infamous name of Hell's Kitchen. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that probably wasn't a very nice place to grow up. He had come into contact with a form of socialism, and his social gospel was really saying that a form of Christianized socialism is what churches ought to be preaching. And all of this meant that you had a huge emphasis during this period on the more social aspects of the gospel. Here are the key figures here: Gladden, Washington Gladden, Charles Sheldon, and Walter Rauschenbusch. It also, as we said, led to churches thinking of far more cooperation. The social gospel people were oftentimes very big on church cooperation, because they argued the churches ought to be cooperating in reaching these. Especially by church cooperation, they weren't thinking Protestant Catholic. This was primarily intra Protestant thing. Most of the Catholic and Jewish immigrants that came in, even the liberal social gospel people, didn't like that. They didn't think the Catholic Church could ever be reformed. It was stuck in some old world medieval sort of mindset. But liberal Protestants, they believed, could cooperate, and they cooperated heavily, for example, during World War I, because patriotism became a very important thing. Billy Sunday, for example, said Christianity and patriotism are synonymous. And so there were serious attempts during World War I. Most of the churches, by the way, entered the war with great enthusiasm. They bought into what Wilson said, make the world safe for democracy, for example. Wilson liked a lot of what was going on. It's interesting, the people who've studied this, and there have been serious studies done of this, have argued that for all of the social gospel's hoopla, if you will, I don't know any other word to use, and the social gospel is oftentimes the darling of certain schools of historians. They love to point out that this is the era of the social gospel. They said as far as real impact on people, the Salvation Army and the rescue missions and a few agencies like that had far more nuts and bolts kind of impact on people than suburban upper middle class people writing books about the social gospel, how we should all get together and go help the poor people. But we're not here in our nice suburban church. And my husband is a white collar executive in a big company, and it all sounded good, but they said the real work was oftentimes done by storefront missions, Salvation Army soup kitchens, and people who were on the cutting edge. And those people far more likely held to some form of evangelical Protestantism liberal theologies that were driving the social gospel. Now, here's where we're gonna need to switch to the next PowerPoint, because we're gonna talk about those new intellectual challenges. Protestantism shaken is the title of the next section. Thank you. And new intellectual challenges. I said, this is a period that I've worked in extensively. And there's probably no period in American religious life that had more intellectual challenges for the Christian faith than this period. Now, there's several factors going on. One, the first thing we should talk about is the new version of universities. This town in which we live, we're used to being universities, 30,000 students, people come from all over, big research universities. We have to remember that this model of the big research university didn't really start until after the Civil War. Pre-Civil War, American education was a very different model, higher education. It was small colleges. A minister was almost always the president. A distinctly Christian understanding of reality was just common. State University of Iowa, in Iowa here, state universities, they had chapel services for everybody when it was first founded. You were expected to go. University of Michigan, for example, was one of the famous universities that had a clergyman in its early days as the president. And they said you could, what you got, the difference between, let's say, small Baptist or Methodist college and the University of Michigan or University of Iowa pre-Civil War, that first of all, the size wasn't that different, those state universities were still small, is they did taught a, quote, non-sectarian version of evangelical Protestantism at the University of Michigan or the University of Iowa, while the Baptist and Methodists were quite okay to teach their sectarian version. But other than that, the education was not all that different. It was modeled under a small college Christian orientation. Post-Civil War, the model changes. Charles Eliot, when he becomes president of Harvard, 1869, Johns Hopkins was founded in 1870s, both clearly decided to model the university after the German research model. What's the difference? First of all, you have the goal of the professors is not to be teachers of small classes who maybe publish a book on the side, but their primary goal is to publish lots of books, lots of articles. And the goal is to produce scholars. And it's a very different model than the earlier model that we had. Much more departmentalization. Majors were hardly a thing anybody knew pre-Civil War. You went to college, got a college degree. Well, if you would have asked somebody in 1840 what was your major, they would have probably scratched their head. Major? What's that? I have a college degree. I studied some philosophy, I studied some literature, I studied some history, some ethics. They called it moral science or something like that. But what's a major? There weren't majors in college. Post-Civil War specialization, this German research model, and the so-called nouveau riche, the Rockefellers of this world. It's no accident that Rockefeller founded the University of Chicago in the 1890s exactly on that model. Think of some of our other universities. We have Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Vanderbilt University in Nashville. Those ought to start ringing the bell to you that there were fat cat businessmen who it was cool for them, if you will, to give big cash outlays and then to get a university named after them. And all of those were research universities. Some of them had, some religious connection loosely. The University of Chicago was loosely connected with the Baptists. It was. However, Rockefeller encouraged the really liberal trend of the Baptist movement, and that's what the University of Chicago became very much noted for. As I said earlier, chapels were required clergy presence, and there's a statistic, 1839, 51 out of the 54 of the U.S.'s largest schools had a clergyman as the president. Post-Civil War, there was none of that. Businessmen and professional educators replaced that. You get the beginning the rise of things like Andrew White's book in 1895, President of Cornell, The History of the Warfare Between Science and Religion. That is a classic example of a different mindset. Now, that book has been proved to have holes you can shoot a mile wide through his thesis in there because some of the greatest scientists were religious. But his thesis was, he was the president of Cornell. His thesis was there's been this warfare between science and religion that's going on. We here at the newfangled universities are here to enlighten the benighted, ignorant people and teach them modern ways of looking at things. During this same period, we have Darwinism, both biological and social. Now, evolution had been around for a while, evolutionary theories, but Darwin made it popular. It is the Origin of the Species in 1859. What the big problem with Darwinism is he challenged the classic argument from design. What's the argument from design? Well, Halley's famous watchmaker analogy. You're walking on a beach, you look down and you find a watch, you don't pick it up, you say, amazing, the watch jumped up right out of the sand. You say, no, somebody probably designed this watch, it has complexity. That's the argument from design. Darwin's theory challenged all of that. Said evolution can explain everything. All the complexity was because it evolved from simple to more complex to more complex to more complex. This would be a huge challenge. Some in the so-called liberal wings adopted Darwinian theory hook, line, and sinker. On the other hand, you had Charles Hodge, famous theologian from Princeton, who wrote a book, What is Darwinism? Toward the end of his career, he opened up the first chapter, he said, I will explain it in further, but in one word, Darwinism is blatant atheism. Well, gives you an idea where what Charles Hodge thought about Darwinism. And he went on to explain why it was, in his mind, totally incompatible with any kind of Orthodox Protestantism. But Charles Hodge was a defender of classic Reformed theology. There were others who imbibed Darwinism. There was also social Darwinism. You might say, what's social Darwinism? A modern example of social Darwinism is the Nazis. The survival of the fittest. We Nazis, we Aryans are the fittest, so it's just fine for us if we exterminate everybody else who's not fit, because we're the fit people. They're not fit. They're subfit. That's the crassest way you can say social Darwinism. Some of the robber barons bought heavily into social Darwinism. I'm fit, so I deserve to be rich. The rest of you are scumbuckets, so you deserve to be toiling in my steel mills while I own the steel mill, because you're not as fit as I am. So there were all kinds of turmoils going on. Now, what you need to realize, though, is sometimes we think of it as two camps. My own thesis, when I wrote it, my thesis in graduate school, was on the Presbyterian moderates. And the very fact that there was a moderate party shows you it's not always easy to put everybody in two camps. There were a lot of people in what you might call the mushy middle. Didn't quite know what to do with all of this. And there were people, for example, there were people who would call themselves theological liberals. Horace Bushnell, Philip Brooks, Episcopalian, great Episcopalian preacher in Boston, who were as opposed to Darwinism as Charles Hodge was. Yet there was a science professor named Asa Gray, who was a Congregationalist, who was an Orthodox Trinitarian Protestant, who was an advocate of Darwinism and believed you could reconcile Darwinism with Orthodox Protestantism. So it's hard to always pin it down. Now, but the most common approach of the so-called moderates was a man named Noah Porter, who was president of Yale from 1871 to 1886. What did he say? I don't have his name up there, but Noah Porter, like the Porter in a Porter car. Noah Porter argued what Orthodox Protestants need to do was to make, in his term, adjustments to traditional faith without throwing most of it out. The problem with that moderate approach was always the question, how many adjustments do you make? Where do you draw the line at what kind of adjustments you make? And it would cause for a period of huge turmoil. And a lot of times this played out in these new research universities who were now training the professors who would be teaching at the theological seminaries. Previously, who taught at theological seminaries? Well, usually it was a man who graduated from a seminary, been a pastor for a few years, and proved to have a fair degree of competence in, let's say, preaching. So you made him a preaching pastor. Or he showed a lot of competence in New Testament commentary. So you made him your New Testament professor. Or competence in theology. So you made him your theology professor. But now it was expected, as the seminaries started looking at these new research universities and thinking, we need to upgrade our academic rigor. We need to get people with PhDs. The PhD first started. Or Johns Hopkins was the first one to offer a PhD in the United States. We need to have people with PhDs on our faculty. Well, see how this works. If the professors who are teaching in your seminary have studied at places like the University of Chicago, where all sorts of challenges to the historic Christian faith, then they come back and teach in a Congregational or Baptist or Presbyterian seminary, and oftentimes would bring back that theory, it would start to percolate down into the churches. Now, lots of people in the pews had no idea any of this was going on. To them, that was just all that highfalutin, highbrow stuff that affected me. But it would eventually affect them. And oftentimes, the so-called moderates were also tended to be peacemakers. My expertise is in the Presbyterian Church, and I know that they were always peacemakers. They got upset at both the liberals and the conservatives for rocking the boat all the time. Why rock the boat? Let's have peace. But in reality, when you study this, the peacemakers who said, let's not rock the boat, generally were the people who opened the floodgates for the more liberal approaches to come in, rather than holding the guard for the more traditional approaches to Christian theology. And it was all done in the name of, let's not rock the boat, let's get on board with missions, we got far, far better things to do than to argue about theology and Darwinism and all this other highfalutin stuff that doesn't affect us anyway. Well, it did affect them. Only it would be 20 or 30 years down the road before it began to affect them when their seminary professors started advocating things that shocked them. Okay? would affect them. That would be the whole question of higher critical views of the Bible. Now, what do we mean by higher critical views of the Bible? It does have German roots. Most of the higher criticism came from Germany. You have to be careful when you talk about criticism of the Bible, because there are two types of criticism. There's so-called lower criticism, which is textual criticism. That's the issue of how do we determine what's the proper text of the New Testament? Well, we have some alternate readings. There's people who study this, textual critics. They'll say we have three slight variations in this verse of a Greek word. Sometimes it'll be just a spelling, or sometimes it'll be a synonym. Which one is the best? Which one's really the original text? And they have developed a whole criteria. There are people who specialize in this. And every Orthodox Protestant seminary that I know of would totally agree with textual lower criticism. We need to discover what the most accurate text is. Higher criticism, on the other hand, though, is something quite different. Higher criticism can be summarized in something like this. We treat the Bible like any other book. We look and try to get behind the text and try to say, let's see if it's been composed not by Moses, for example, the classic one who claimed, traditionally people claimed wrote the Pentateuch, but maybe it was composed as the classic JEDP by four different authors, and some clever editor cut and pasted it together, not very well. And there was a famous JEDP theory, which said that the book of Exodus, for example, is a hodgepodge of a whole, not even contradictory sorts of things. It generally took an approach that the Bible was shot full of all sorts of errors, historical ones in particular, but eventually some would say even doctrinal errors. It would have approached the Bible as something that evolved. Generally, oftentimes the German higher critical theories, well, the early Israelites really weren't monotheists, they were henotheists. What was that? It means that they believed Yahweh was the highest God. And the other groups had their own gods, but Yahweh was just the highest God. And eventually people read back into that after about 400 or 500 years and said, well, of course, we always believed Yahweh was the only God. And so they read it back into it and put it back in there, try to clumsily put it back in the text by editing it in a certain way. This is what higher criticism did. Now, the U.S. did not get affected by this much before the Civil War. A handful of scholars dabbled in it, but most did not. After the Civil War, connected with the very same issues that led to the rise of universities, led, of course, to the rise of higher standards for theological seminaries. And if that's the latest hot learning, can you see how, if you're up to date and scholarly, why the draw is, well, that's what's up to date and scholarly, higher criticism. Now, eventually you get people like David Strauss, who argued that most of the Gospels were, for example, a total myth. He argued that there was almost nothing historically accurate in the Gospels whatsoever, and Jesus was just a good man, and the church invented all of this. That's what higher criticism eventually in Germany led to. Most Americans took milder versions of that. For example, many of them, strangely enough, would be willing to apply it to the Old Testament, and they'd get nervous when they tried to apply it to the Gospels. Somehow the idea, they wanted Jesus to be historical, but they didn't care. Abraham and Moses, that's okay, they mess with those guys. But don't mess with Jesus. You know, because they have this in the Sheldon Jeep, you know, follow what would Jesus do mindset. Well, if you can't trust anything, how can you do a what would Jesus do if it's all a myth anyway? So they didn't want them to touch the gospel, but they were quite okay with messing around with Moses and Abraham and everybody else in the Old Testament. But it also came down to a new notion of religious authority. We've seen a little bit of this before, but most of the practitioners of higher criticism in Germany would identify with the so-called new, so-called Protestant liberalism that theologians like Friedrich Schleiermacher, that was his name, Schleiermacher, German, advocated. And the difference between Protestant liberalism and classic, all forms of classic orthodoxy is this. It doesn't matter whether you're talking about Protestant or Catholic or Eastern Orthodox views of orthodoxy, Orthodox Christianity. They all start from an assumption that there's an external authority. Protestants, it's the Bible. Catholics, it's the Bible and tradition and the Pope. Eastern Orthodoxy, it's the Bible and tradition, but it's always an external authority. And you are under the authority of that external authority. Protestant liberalism reverses that. It says the authority is your experience. That's the final authority. It then allows you to judge the scripture. And the scripture becomes a place that gives you a really good example of experience. Schleiermacher argued Jesus was a man who had experienced dependence upon God, because he defined religion as dependence upon God, the experience of dependence upon God. And he argued that Jesus, he had the perfect, pure dependence upon God, and that's why he is our Savior, because he models for us what pure dependence upon God can look like. That's what it means that Jesus is the Savior. He has pure dependence. Was he divine? Well, not really. But he had pure dependence upon God, so that makes him a cut above all of us. You see the argument here. You see how distinctly different. What does the cross become? Well, Jesus showed his dependence upon God and was willing to show us how much he loved us by going to the cross. Pure moral influence views of the atonement. All of this flows out of this starting point, that religious experience. Well, a lot of evangelical Protestants have been weaned on religious experience. Revivalistic Protestantism was heavy on experience, and they didn't see the shift that had gone on here. You see how easy it would be if you're weaned in a tradition that emphasizes experience so much and downplays doctrine. Well, for example, Schleiermacher was raised, founder of German liberalism, was raised in a pietistic home. Someone asked him about his theology once, and he said it's a pietism of a new order, a higher order. Not that different than my pietistic religion I was raised in. But outsiders, people like Hodge and other Orthodox theologians, said, wait a minute, it's a total different kettle of fish. You've shifted gears for us here. So you've got this combination of higher critical views of the Bible combined with this new authority. Because if your authority is in your religious experience, then you feel free to approach the Bible like any other book. But if the Bible is your authoritative, infallible authority, you're not going to want to treat it like any other book. And that is really the difference. Now, there would be some people who tried to run, like I said, a middle ground. There were people who sometimes would try to still define theology in terms of experience, but it didn't really flow very well. And what you had is the fracturing in the beginning of parties developing in the denominations in the 1890s. It would really blow up in the 1920s. And we're going to have to get to that next week, the so-called fundamentalist modernist crisis. And I'll give you a little bit more background on this. But it will blow up when people on the conservative side begin pushing for reining in and trying to get rid of the so-called modernists. That was another term for the theological liberals. They were heresy triads. People like Charles Briggs, who were brought up under heresy trials in the Presbyterian Church. He bolted and went and joined the Episcopal Church rather than facing the heresy trials. I read a number of Briggs' letters and part of my thesis and worked with it. But there were people who were in the moderate camp who, there was one man, for example, a guy named Morris, Orthodox Presbyterian with a small O, but he was a moderate. He didn't like ruffling the feathers. He wanted to keep a lid on it. And he wrote these letters, and I read some of them to Briggs, the guy who was advocating higher criticism, liberal theology. And he said, now Charles, he said, with all your wild theories, you're upsetting those of us who want a moderate progressivism. We want to change just a few things. Your wild and crazy ideas, you look at, you get the people down at Princeton all riled up, you know, and then they want to have heresy trials. Just cool it. He would say things like, cool it, you know. Don't cause all this, don't advocate all these wild theories that you have, because it causes all kinds of trouble. He wanted to keep the lid on everything. Let's have everything cool and calm, like a good moderate. Let's all get along. Well, it proved impossible for everybody to get along. And we'll have to talk about that when we get into the fundamentalist crisis, modernist crisis next week. And we'll talk about that, and we'll get into the 30s, and probably hopefully the 40s, and then the 2 weeks from now, we'll hopefully bring it more up to date. Okay. Any questions? You got thousands of manuscripts from about